It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Since the 1990s, the U.S. has seen a dramatic rise in deaths classified as accidental. The death toll from unintentional injuries in the country is now over 200,000 a year, according to the CDC's latest confirmed numbers, making it the third most likely way to die in the United States. For people aged 1 through 44, these incidents are the number one cause of death. Our next guest says we're in a modern accident epidemic, but it doesn't have to be this way. In her book, There Are No Accidents, she says we need to rethink these kinds of injuries and deaths and tackle the underlying causes behind them. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you work or live in a place where there seem to be a lot of what you'd describe as accidents? Have you ever experienced one of these incidents on the job? Have you worked in an unsafe workplace? Has OSHA ever visited a workplace where you worked? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jesse Singer is a journalist and the author of the award-winning book, There Are No Accidents, The Deadly Rise of Injury and Disaster, Who Profits and Who Pays the Price. She's an expert in safe systems, injury prevention, and harm reduction, and will be the keynote speaker at the Wisconsin Healthy Communities Summit on April 29th. Jesse, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Given those numbers I just gave, accidental deaths, a top cause of death in the United States, I feel like we don't think of them as a category. We don't have awareness campaigns for this as a whole. Why don't we pay more attention to this in general?
You know, I think that this idea of the accident is incredibly intoxicating. And in my research, I found again and again this deep-seated desire that we all had to sort of brush off this massive category of harm. And just to be clear, what we're talking about here is unintentional injury. And that includes everything from traffic crashes to fires to falls to drownings to drug poisonings, a massive category of harm. But all these things that we like to just pretend are the product of individual mistakes, that someone screwed up and therefore the worst happened. But if you actually track back these incidences, track them through history, and track individual deaths today, you find a story that there's nothing random here. And rather, actually, what we call accidental death is predictable, preventable, and not at all random. And, you know, there are a lot of ways that this might, you know, jar people. People might be saying, wait, no. I saw that traffic crash on the highway. That there's no way that was anything more than an accident. But while there are a lot of ways in all of these individual categories to explain how these events are predictable and preventable and built into the landscape we live in, the simplest way to look at the big picture is this. This is a uniquely American problem. Among wealthy nations, we die by accident at a much higher rate. So that's one way you could prove that this is absolutely not random. But here's another. It didn't used to happen here. The death rate by accident in this country fell for decades before this most recent rise, and those deaths have been rising since 1992. Now, Europeans aren't more careful people. Conditions are different in Europe. We in America didn't get more accident prone. Conditions changed here. And I look this up in case some of your listeners don't believe me. Wisconsin has a higher rate of accidental death than every adjacent state, higher than Michigan, Illinois, Iowa, and Minnesota. So I would ask your listeners, are you clumsier in Wisconsin? Are you more accident prone? No, conditions are different. Conditions are different in different states, in different economies, in different cities and counties, and we see different rates of death. For all these things, we chalk up to randomness.
And a lot of the safety experts you talk to, and I've heard this from traffic people here in Wisconsin, steering clear of the word accident in the first place. Why is that?
Well, I think it's exactly for the same reason that we don't correlate all of these unintentional injuries. Because calling something an accident means that it was random and unpreventable, and it gives us a way to gloss it over, to individualize it, to make it about one human error as the problem, rather than the systemic design of our roads, of our workplaces, of our homes, how these things are built into the environment. And it's comforting to call something an accident. It makes us feel better, but it all but guarantees that the same so-called accidents happen the same way again and again and again.
Sadly, one story that you used to illustrate this throughout your book was a very personal one for you. A beloved friend killed in a traffic, what we might call accident, if we didn't think more about it. Can you share, if you're able, his story a little bit and the wider story behind it?
Yeah, yeah. In fact, yes, the New York Times called my best friend's death an accident. And that story starts in 2006. Eric Ng was my best friend. He was 22 years old. He was wonderful. A New York City high school math teacher. The sweetest, funniest guy. And he was riding his bike on a separate bike path that runs along the west side of Manhattan in New York City, where we live. And he was killed by a drunk driver who had mistakenly turned and entered this bike path. Now, that guy was drunk and speeding, and he went to prison. And for a long time, that was the end of the story. It was an accident. There was a drunk driver. But then 11 years later, a different man rented a truck, and he followed the exact same route as my best friend's killer. Except this second man, he intentionally turned onto this bike path. Now, this is the most heavily trafficked bike path in America. And he killed 8 people and severely injured 11 in an act of vehicular terrorism. And I remember being so shocked that someone had died in the exact same way, in the exact same place. And that the only thing that was different was the intention. One was an accident and one was a terrorist attack, right? And so I started to look into it, and I learned that the place where my best friend was killed had been the site of death for other people before and after Eric, on the same path. Now, every time, the drivers were different. You know, some were distracted, some were lost, some were drunk. And every time, the story that was told was it was an accident. And so no problems were solved. It was chalked up to human error. And the fact that this bike path was inherently a high-risk place, that it looked just like the road next to it, that there was nothing blocking drivers from entering it, like, allowed this harm to happen again and again and again. Now, after the terrorist attack, the city made the harm impossible. They put up a bollard at every single entrance to this bike path. So you could still go on there with a bike, but you couldn't drive your car down it anymore. And for me, it was this realization that accident was this magic word of willful ignorance, you know, that we use to be okay with preventable harm, that we individualized these people dying and the problem every time, a sort of magical thinking. And then we let people die until it stopped being an accident, you know. All of those deaths could have been prevented if we treated these accidents as systemic problems, problems of design, problems of the conditions and the environments that we face.
We're talking to Jesse Singer, author of the book, There Are No Accidents, The Deadly Rise of Injury and Disaster, Who Profits and Who Pays the Price. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Another story you tell in the book, Jesse, is that the rise of the use of the word accident wasn't really an accident. There were motivations, often corporate and business motivations, over the years to ascribe things to personal failings. Can you start with the story of what we now call jaywalking and how pedestrians became, instead of the victims of a problem, the causes of their own problems?
This is a fascinating story. It occurs in a time as the automobile is becoming more popularized. And as a result, traffic fatalities are rising. More people own cars, and in cities, more people are getting struck and hit by cars. And this is a big problem for automakers, because people's reaction to these early traffic deaths are that cars are inherently dangerous. And they start to protest the idea that cars are even allowed in cities. Now, a little bit of language here. So jaywalker is a portmanteau. Jay is like an old-timey word for hillbilly. So a jaywalker is like a country bumpkin who doesn't know how to operate on city streets. And so before the 1920s, there was no such thing as a jaywalker. People walked in the street all the time, and that was just the norm. But today, in every state in the nation, it's the law that if a car strikes a jaywalking person, the person walking is at fault. And this is actually a transformation that took a concerted effort by automakers, because to sell cars, they had to make the car not the villain of the traffic crash. And so in these cases where a person walking was hit, they tried to villainize the jaywalker. They popularized the term, buying newspaper ads so it would appear in the press, creating news services that cataloged traffic accidents that always seemed to blame the jaywalker. They even bought signs for cities that read jaywalking prohibited, even though it wasn't a law anywhere yet. Now, obviously this was massively successful. Today we all think of jaywalking as wrong and bad. And if you get hit by a car in the street, it's your fault. And not the fact that cars are inherently dangerous machines to have in pedestrian-dense cities. Now, if folks want to read more about that, there's an excellent history of it in Peter Norton's Fighting Traffic. But the whole story is a great example of how intoxicating it can be to blame human error, to individualize these problems, and how easily we are distracted from inherently dangerous conditions, like big cars on city streets. And how drawing a focus on human error and individualizing these problems can serve private interests. It can sell cars. It can let factory owners maintain dangerous workplaces. It can distract us all from the fact that we do have systems in place that could protect us, but that it's profitable for corporations for us not to be protected.
Jesse Singer is with us, author of the book, There Are No Accidents. She'll be in Wisconsin next month to give the keynote talk, the Wisconsin Healthy Communities Summit on April 29th. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions or thoughts about how to make roads, workplaces, or healthcare systems more safe? Have you ever been harmed by a mistake that someone else made? Did you think it was their fault, or was there something else more fundamental that made the condition unsafe in the first place? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up the conversation with journalist Jesse Singer about her book, There Are No Accidents, The Deadly Rise of Injury and Disaster, Who Profits and Who Pays the Price. Jesse will give the keynote address at the Wisconsin Healthy Community Summit on April 29th. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest about how to rethink the causes of accidents, unintentional injuries, the third leading cause of death in the United States? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Terry is with us in Winnebago County. Terry, hi.
Hi. I would like to comment on an early comment that your guest made about Wisconsin having more accidents than all of the states around us. And if I remember correctly, I think the last time I saw a study about alcohol consumption, different communities in Wisconsin were like 6 or 7 of the top 10. And I would submit that alcohol consumption is a large part of this problem of accidents.
Terry, thanks for the call. And Jesse, that's what popped into my head too. There is data on drinking and driving in Wisconsin, alcohol-related falls in Wisconsin causing problems. If we were to approach this in the way that you're talking about in the book, as opposed to or in addition to, you know, ticketing people for drunk driving, things like that, what might be a systemic approach to try to tackle a problem like that?
This is such a good question, because I think drinking especially gets at this urge for us to blame individuals. Now, I looked into the numbers coming on because I was surprised to see how much worse things were in Wisconsin, the neighboring states. And it seems the vast majority of your higher rates of accidental deaths come from falls. And I think you're right. A lot of those could be alcohol related. They could be weather related. They could be weather plus alcohol related. But the question is, right, well, what do you do about people getting drunk and falling, and also older population related, all of those things combined? And, you know, you could tell people not to drink. You could fine people for not drinking, but I think anyone who knows anyone who drinks knows that that's not gonna work. And so I'm gonna cite, I'm gonna quote a safety expert who's in my book, and she told me, this is one of the people who pioneered the child car seat. She created the injury severity score. Dr. Susan P. Baker, she's a famous epidemiologist. And she said her most controversial opinion was this: we need to make the world safe for drunks. Because if we make the world safe for drunks, we make it safe for people who are sleepy, for moms who are distracted by children in the back seat, for people who are worried about a conversation with their boss later. And what that means, making the world safe for drunks, is making the world safe for imperfect people. Now, how does that relate to drinking? One way is building regulations, ADA accessibility, the sort of things that make spaces more navigable for people who don't have their full abilities would definitely make things safer for people who are drunk. snow and ice clearing regulations that make sure people have safe paths between places. Another thing that occurs is, you know, looking at drinking and social programs with transportation. You know, there's really good evidence from Washington, D.C., that providing public transportation directly reduces DUIs. So all of these things can affect how being drunk might cause harm. And I think that's the key way to look at it. We want to reduce the harm of drinking. And the harm isn't the drinking in this case. The harm is the falling while drunk, right? So if we want to do that, all we need to do is put sort of pillows, figurative ones, between us and our mistakes, between us and our falls. And this can occur on the state level, you know, when we're talking about building regulations, when we're talking about, you know, grab bars and cushioning blows and how we help people who have fallen get out of the hospital and still be able-bodied by keeping them exercising in the hospital. But we can also do this on the federal level. Like currently, the federal government, the Consumer Product Safety Commission, has no standard for a safe floor. Like those words mean nothing. There's no such thing as an official, safe, non-slip floor. And so when people are building senior homes and hospitals and even bars, you know, places where people are more likely to slip, there's no tested form to prove that a floor is less likely to let you slip. Now, the federal government could be regulating that. They could be creating a standard for a safe floor. So places that have more of a fall risk could be making their environment safer and just assuming that people are going to get drunk and that our goal, instead of trying to police behavior, which we know doesn't work, could be reducing the likelihood that that behavior is going to cause harm.
Thanks for that call, Terry. Talking to Jesse Singer, author of the book, There Are No Accidents. Jesse, I think we might all think, hey, an accident, it could happen to any of us at any time. Another key point in your book is there are some people in our country who are more vulnerable to accidents based on income and race and other conditions. How does this affect us differently?
This is very true, and this is very important, especially for people who are still on the, you know, listening in and saying, what? Accidents are random. Accidents are unpredictable. If accidents are random, then injury-related death would fall randomly across the country. It does not. People living in poverty and people of color are more likely to die by accident. And this is especially true for accidents where policy and infrastructure make the difference between life and death. Safety of our homes, our roads, our workplaces. To name a few examples, just to show you how stark the numbers are. Black people are more than twice as likely to die in a house fire as white people. Indigenous people are more than twice as likely to be struck and killed by drivers as white people. People living in West Virginia, which is a relatively poor state, are more than twice as likely to die by accident than people just across the state line living in Virginia, just a few miles away. A way to understand this is that policy decisions lead to risk unequally distributed across the U.S. And so while we often think of accidents as a matter of personal responsibility, they're actually a matter of risk exposure, and we're not all exposed to the same risk.
What can we do about this? You give a number of possible policy changes toward the end of your book. A lot of them might take years of effort to get there. What do you see as low-hanging fruit that can make a big difference in a fairly short time horizon?
Picture, this is a regulatory problem that needs a regulatory solution. And I hear you, that is big and long, but I don't think anyone should stop talking to their elected officials on the federal level about the need to regulate, about the power of regulations, because we see it across the board. Workplaces that face OSHA inspections, workers are less likely to die there. It's true of when NHTSA regulates cars and so on and so forth. But when it comes down to it, there's so much you can be doing locally. There are a million ways to prevent accidental death. So in your community, looking at traffic calming, speed governors on city-owned vehicles, public transit expansions are all going to reduce the likelihood of traffic fatalities. Opening safe injection sites and giving free naloxone to everyone in your community is going to reduce the likelihood that anyone dies from taking too much drugs. Incorporating ADA accessibility and strict building regulations that are enforced, like ramps and grab bars, are going to reduce the likelihood that a fall is a death sentence. Fire safety regulations, like sprinklers and self-closing doors, are the difference between a fire and a deadly fire. There are 10,000 little answers. And I think at the core of them, I would ask you to remember what Dr. Baker said. Making the world safe for drunks. Every time you see or hear about an accident, say like, how could this environment be safe for a drunk person? And say it without judgment. Don't worry about the behavior. Focus on putting a pillow between us and our mistakes and our bad decisions. Look for ways to turn away from personal responsibility and individual blame and towards systemic protections that reduce harm for everyone, even when we screw up.
As I mentioned, you're presenting at the Wisconsin Healthy Communities Summit on April 29th. Do you sense a hunger from local communities to start making these kind of changes just in our last minute or so?
I think absolutely. I think people are tired of hearing about things that are chalked up to accidents. I think more and more people are questioning this idea. I mean, if you look at the recent Boeing crashes, the Norfolk Southern train derailment, more and more communities are affected by these so-called accidental disasters, are seeing these one-off accidents in their communities and saying, if it keeps happening on the same street, is it really an accident? If the same people are always dying, is it really an accident? And why isn't my community seeing change? There are so many ways we can bring these changes locally to protect people, even when they make mistakes. And I think there's a real hunger to make those changes. And hopefully we can talk about that on April 29th and going forward.
Jesse, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
It was my pleasure.
That's Jesse Singer, journalist, expert in safe systems, injury prevention, and harm reduction. We've been talking about her book. It's called There Are No Accidents, The Deadly Rise of Injury and Disaster, Who Profits and Who Pays the Price. Jesse will be the keynote speaker at the Wisconsin Healthy Communities Summit on April 29th. You can learn more at wisconsinbikefed.org. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Last week, a state appeals court ruled that the Department of Natural Resources policies on the cleanup of PFAS chemicals can't be enforced. Attorney General Josh Call says he'll appeal the ruling at the state Supreme Court. And Governor Tony Evers has been clashing with the legislature over $125 million in funding to address the state's PFAS problem. We're checking out the politics of PFAS cleanup in the state. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the state DNR should have broad authority to handle PFAS pollution and require cleanup? What should be done about landowners whose properties are contaminated with the chemicals? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. WPR reporter Danielle Kading has been following these stories. I talked to her earlier this week. All right, we got this appeals court ruling saying that DNR policy on PFAS was against the law. Can you talk us through the initial challenge and what got us to this point?
So the initial challenge was brought a few years ago by Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce against the State Department of Natural Resources, and Oconomowoc-based dry cleaner Leather Rich also joined in that lawsuit. And basically, they were challenging the DNR's authority related to some policy changes they made that were tied to a program where landowners voluntarily agree to clean up contamination. And in exchange for that, they would face limited liability in the future. And so basically they argued that the DNR, through these policy changes, had basically adopted rules that were unlawful and couldn't be enforced, and a Waukesha County judge ruled in their favor, and the appeals court ruling basically upheld that ruling.
Now, it gets a little complicated here, Danny, and hopefully you can help untangle this for me. This is ultimately about how regulations and policy changes happen and how much authority an agency like the DNR has to do something like this without getting specific rulemaking approved by the legislature. I think I have that right so far. Talk us through that.
Yeah. So, you know, in Wisconsin, generally, when we have regulations that are passed, they go through the state's rulemaking process. And that means that any regulations that are proposed by agencies like the Department of Natural Resources are subject to legislative approval and approval by the governor. And while we've seen the Republican-controlled legislature approve standards for PFAS in drinking water and surface water, or at least not object to them anyway, the DNR has tried twice to develop groundwater limits for chemicals such as PFAS without success. And that's due largely to opposition from conservative and business interests, as well as excessive compliance costs with implementing those rules. And since that process, the rulemaking process, can take years, environmental advocates and residents say that would delay relief even more for them and could be subject to more opposition from putting standards in place related to those interests who have objected previously.
As I understand it, this appeals court ruling isn't going to be the last word on the subject. We're looking at a likely appeal to that appeal. Danny, what is going on?
Yeah, so when that ruling came out last week, Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call said that the Department of Justice is going to appeal that ruling to the state Supreme Court on behalf of the DNR because they've been representing the agency in that case. And basically, they're arguing that this ruling, this decision, could undermine the DNR's ability to protect safe and clean drinking water. And they think that there's another interpretation, and they think they have a good standing for this Supreme Court to take this case because it was a divided opinion. It was a 2-1 decision. And so they're going to be arguing in favor of Wisconsin's spills law and the authority that has been granted to the DNR under that as a reason why they can do what they have previously been doing and still are continuing to do, which is regulate hazardous substances like PFAS and require certain entities to clean up that contamination.
And you just mentioned, Danny, they're continuing to do this. The current status while this appeal is waiting is what? There's a hold on these rulings?
Yes, there is a hold from the Waukesha County judge. He basically prevented any, you know, ruling or decision from taking effect. So that means that the department, the DNR, can continue under the spills law to work with those responsible for contamination to clean up PFAS. And it also means that people who have private wells that have been contaminated by these chemicals, that they'll still be able to receive emergency bottled water in the meantime through the authority that's been granted to them under the spills law. So their authority remains in place until a final decision is issued.
WPR reporter Danielle Kading is with us looking at PFAS chemicals in the courts and in the state legislature. Danny, another story you've been following, a back and forth between Governor Evers and the Republican-led state legislature over funding to address some of our state's PFAS problems. What's going on there?
Yeah, that's right, Robin. If you remember, you know, last year while they were going through the budget process, lawmakers set aside $125 million to address PFAS. They put that in a trust fund, and that was approved under the current 2-year budget. And that's intended to help local governments and landowners address PFAS pollution. But they said at that time that, you know, there was going to be legislation passed to implement how those dollars would be spent. And so there has been debate in the legislature between Republicans and Democrats and Governor Tony Evers over a GOP bill that would address contamination. And the real sticking point with that is that Democrats and Evers are arguing that this legislation would limit the DNR's authority to test for and clean up the chemicals. And I can go more into that if you'd like.
Yeah. What? How would it do that?
So essentially, this legislation that's been sponsored by Green Bay Republican Senators Eric Wimberger and Rob Coles would prevent the DNR from taking enforcement action against people deemed innocent landowners. And what that means is that as long as these so-called innocent landowners let the agency clean up the chemicals at the state's expense, then they would be able to take care of this contamination. And then it would let property owners who have contamination through no fault of their own have those chemicals cleaned up. It would also require the DNR to seek permission from landowners to test for PFAS, and it would limit the agency's ability to require testing unless the agency had some sort of probable cause to believe that PFAS levels would go beyond state or federal standards. But Evers has said that he will veto the bill and has offered a compromise instead. And Republicans and Evers and the Democrats just aren't seeing eye to eye on this one.
But I think the legislative term is running out, or the session is running out. Danny, what are you watching for next as this back and forth over PFAS funding goes on?
Yeah, unless there's some sort of compromise between Evers and the legislature's budget writing committee, it looks like people, communities, and landowners will be waiting months for financial aid. I mean, it would really take the legislature's budget writing committee or the finance committee to take some action to award these funds unless some sort of deal can be reached. And so we'll be watching to see if the committee takes action separate from the governor, or if the governor and the committee can work out some sort of deal, or if there's some other unimagined option that I have not yet foreseen.
Danny, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on, Rob.
Danielle Kading is a reporter covering the environment, energy, and Northern Wisconsin for WPR's Superior Bureau. She talked to us about the latest news on PFAS. Coming up, we'll hear from an expert on water policy and laws here in Wisconsin. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Is PFAS contamination a problem in your community? What do you want to see the state do about it when it comes to surface water, drinking water, or groundwater? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the latest news on PFAS chemicals and pollution in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if this has been an issue in your community. Do you want the DNR to have more or less authority to regulate PFAS and its cleanup? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. David Strifling joins us now, Director of the Water Law and Policy Initiative and Associate Professor at Marquette Law School. Dave, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be with you again, Rob. Thank you.
We just got the latest twists and turns there with Danny. Dave, what, big picture, what concern do we have about PFAS in groundwater in particular here in Wisconsin?
Well, that was a tremendous report by Danielle Kading. I think looking at the big picture, the biggest potential losers here are those Wisconsinites who are on private wells for their drinking water. They're at the biggest risk for PFAS contamination because the DNR has already enacted rules related to drinking water and surface water. It's groundwater that's the big loophole here, and so they should have the biggest concern.
And this will be in mostly, I assume, rural parts of the state where you mentioned the distinction between drinking water and groundwater for people with wells. Ultimately, groundwater is their drinking water, right?
Exactly right. So we're talking about those who are on, you know, single well systems here, not on a municipal groundwater system.
So we've got this debate over how much authority the DNR has to require cleanup of PFAS in groundwater. What is your take on this back and forth we were just hearing about?
Well, from the DNR's point of view, this is sort of a case of bad facts make bad law, I'm sure, where, you know, they kind of tried to get this landowner, Leather Rich, the dry cleaner, to clean up PFAS in the midst of an ongoing cleanup. And so, you know, from their perspective, this is, you know, not the ideal way that a cleanup should work. But from WMC's perspective, you know, the thinking here is that they should know what's required of them, and that DNR shouldn't be able to change the rules midstream. So you can see both sides of it, the perspectives here. And the question is, you know, what is a hazardous substance? And obviously our conception of what a hazardous substance is can change over time with some of these emerging contaminants like PFAS. So the real root of the problem is, how do we handle things like that when we become aware of new contaminants out there in the environment? What authority should the DNR have to react and respond to that quickly?
Can you give us a little history of our rising realization that PFAS is very commonly used in consumer products and others, a commonly used class of chemicals, is something that's A, hazardous, and B, pervasive in a lot of our water in the state.
Well, that's right. And it's not just in our water. I think it's, you know, if all of us in Wisconsin were tested, the great majority of us would have PFAS in our bloodstream. So this stuff is everywhere. It's in food packaging and firefighting foam and cosmetics and plastics and all sorts of other consumer products. And I think that's why you're seeing a number of states react with bans of one sort or another as our scientific knowledge has grown about, you know, these forever chemicals. They're useful for a purpose because they're long lasting and they don't break down, but that causes problems when humans and animals and the environment is exposed to them.
Speaking of bans, I believe the state of Maine has a fairly broad ban on PFAS chemicals used in production. Some Democrats in the state have proposed a bill that would ban PFAS in most products, starting, I think, in 2028. What would that do? What kind of impact could that have?
Yeah, there are a few states that have done that. Maine was the first, I believe. And all of these bans are phased bans. They're not immediate bans. So there would be some time for industry to react. I think the Wisconsin one would be in certain types of products starting in 2028 and then a complete ban by 2034. But still, there's going to be opposition to that from WMC and others who contend that PFAS are safe in some contexts when they're used properly and contained. So I think the Wisconsin bill was described by the sponsors as aspirational, and I think that's exactly what it is. It's a conversation starter at this point. I don't see any serious possibility that this is going to be passed anytime soon in Wisconsin, but it is exactly that, a conversation starter.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us in New London. Mike, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on. I personally wish the DNR professional scientists and health professionals should have the most power in making this decision. This is not a political topic, although the GOP is doing parallel to what they did with COVID. That's my comment. Thank you.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. And Dave, Mike hits on a very fundamental question here. The state legislature passes laws that empower state agencies, in this case the DNR, to do stuff, to regulate things. But there's a question of how much latitude that agency is being given and how much they have to come back and hammer out more specific authorities with the legislature. How big a factor is that in this argument in the first place, Dave?
Yeah, it's a huge factor, especially in Wisconsin, which has swung pretty far when it comes to the pendulum away from agency power and towards legislative power. The way it stands now, the agency basically needs legislative authority to issue any rule, put a condition in any permit, do almost anything that it wants to do. So at least when it comes to PFAS in groundwater and in a lot of other topics, too, really, the DNR is kind of at the mercy of the legislature on this one.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to David Strifling, Director of the Water Law and Policy Initiative, Associate Professor at Marquette Law School, looking at PFAS in Wisconsin water and elsewhere and state efforts to clean it up, prevent it, and more. Still time for your call at 800-642-1234. We have this $125 million set aside in a state budget, Dave, for PFAS cleanup. It is stalled as empowering rules and legislation. The Republicans in the legislature want it one way. Governor Evers wants it another. Talk about the differences of opinion in there and why it's slowing down the process.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. As the caller said, this has sort of become a partisan political issue. I think there's broad consensus, actually, that PFAS are a problem and something needs to be done about them. By both Republicans and Democrats. But the issue is goes back to what we've been talking about, which is how much power the DNR should have. And Governor Evers sees that question one way, and the Republican-controlled legislature sees it a different way. And that's the root of the problem here, because, you know, I think the bill that was passed in the legislature would have authorized the release of much of the $125 million, not immediately, but over time. The issue was that Governor Evers thought it contained a poison pill that Danielle described, restricting the authority of the DNR to order cleanups. And so until that issue is resolved, I think we're kind of stuck in neutral here.
do we really have ways to clean up PFAS effectively? I could see $125 million being a lot of money, or I could see it being a drop in the bucket for getting a pervasive chemical, say, out of groundwater around the state.
Yeah, I think the best answer there is we're working on it. Lots of good scientists are working on the best ways to do that. It's not easy to do, and I think $125 million would go pretty quickly, especially when you think about some of the larger cities in Wisconsin that have been affected by PFAS in drinking water. You need very advanced treatment technologies to remove it, and those don't come cheap. That's certainly true.
Let's go back to our callers. Robert is with us in Amherst Junction. Robert, hi.
Hi. After I called, I heard the guest kind of say what I was intending to say, which is in Wisconsin, the legislature right now is pro-industry. And when WMC and other industry groups put out their idea of what they want to do, they can stall anything. They could stall the controls around lead. They could stall controls around atrazine. They have stalled controls. They are stalling controls around nitrates in groundwater in central Wisconsin. They are only trying to stall the process.
Robert, thanks a lot for the call. That is not exactly what you said, Dave. So what do you think about what Robert brought up?
Yeah, I don't mean to ascribe any particular motivation to the legislature here or describe, why they're doing what they're doing. I think the issue here is something that was described by an earlier caller and by you, Rob, which is, do you believe that we should leave this in the hands of agency experts? Do you believe that those are the scientists and that's why we have them to do this job? Or do you believe that they are unelected bureaucrats run amok? And, those polar opposite views here are what is slowing down the release of those funds and cleanup of PFAS in Wisconsin. So until we can meet in the middle somewhere, and I'm still hopeful that we can, we're going nowhere fast.
Thanks for that call. Liz joins us now in Lyons. Liz, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Liz?
I'm from Georgia, and I've never heard the word PFAS before. And I also, my water comes from a well. Do I need to be concerned at all?
Liz, thanks for the call. To her first point, Dave, I know this is a big thing in Wisconsin. I haven't really looked at what's going on in the rest of the country on PFAS. Is this a particular problem in the state, or is this something that's happening nationwide?
No, this is a nationwide issue. And I think the problem here is that EPA has been very slow to act at the federal level. And so that's left a sort of patchwork quilt of state regulations. Some have gone far along the way of regulating PFAS, and others have done nothing at all. So it really depends where you live at this point until EPA steps in.
And Liz mentioned she relies on well water. As you mentioned earlier, Dave, they are the people potentially most affected by a delay in enforcement and remediation here. Are there things that you know of that people can do who have well water to find out if PFAS is a problem and then start to try to figure out what to do about it?
Right. So a couple of things. One is to check whether you're on a well or whether you are on a private well. If you're on a municipal well, you're going to be covered by the DNR's drinking water regulations. Those are public water systems, even though they're on a well. Those that are in the gray area or unregulated at this point are those who are on a private well, not a municipal system, but a private well. And you can have those tested for PFAS, but it's not required in the same way that it will be for the municipal water systems.
Liz, thanks for the call. And Dave, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
David Strifling is director of the Water Law and Policy Initiative and associate professor at Marquette Law School. He talked to us about some of the latest news on PFAS chemicals in Wisconsin water. Earlier, we heard from WPR reporter Danielle Kading. You could follow her ongoing now for a long time work on PFAS-related issues around the state. Check out that and other news over at WPR.org or download the Wisconsin Public Radio app. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, check out the state of the state's economy and how national trends are affecting Wisconsin. You can join in with your own thoughts, your questions, and how you're experiencing the economy in the state. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll check out our maple syrup season here in Wisconsin, mainly the production and processing side of things. Let's talk for a minute about what we do with it. The obvious ones, put it on pancakes, waffles. I did that just the other day. And on Food Friday over the years, we've gotten recipes for savory dishes using maple syrup. More and more, I drink it. Not straight up. I have a sweet tooth, yeah, but not that sweet. I ran into a cocktail a couple years back with bourbon, lemon, and maple syrup over lots of ice. In my own version, I add fresh orange juice into the mix, and it makes a great refreshing mocktail. Just leave out the bourbon, mix together fresh squeezed orange and lemon juice, a little bit of maple syrup, maybe a couple drops of bitters for extra flavor, stirred in with ice and water, or you could sub in iced black tea for water for another layer of flavor. Just be careful. A little maple syrup goes a long way. The key, balance the sweet of the maple syrup with the tart of the lemon. Let us know what you do with maple syrup. Email ideas at WPR.org. That's ideas at WPR.org. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin's unusually warm winter weather has caused problems for some of the state's outdoor industries that rely on snow and ice. And it's had an impact on a state industry that's also a tradition. Many maple syrup producers have already started tapping their trees for sap weeks, maybe even months earlier than a typical year. An early tree tapping season creates challenges of its own. It could also make for a longer season and potentially more production. We're checking in on how this year's maple syrup season is going in Wisconsin, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you or someone close to you tap maple trees for sap? What are you seeing in your area, your own backyard? Are you a fan of Wisconsin maple syrup? Do you have questions about how it's made and the industry here in our state? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. Tony Johnson is a forestry outreach specialist and natural resources educator for UW Extension. He's the project manager for the UW Extension Maple Syrup Program. Tony, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me. Really excited to be on the show today.
Now, my understanding is usually you'd look at the calendar and right about now would be sap season in Wisconsin, right? What's going on in reality?
Yeah, that's right. We're having a pretty atypical year this year. I was actually, one of the events I was hoping to mention is the annual first tree tapping from the Wisconsin Maple Syrup Producers Association is scheduled to take place this weekend. But if you know any maple syrup producers in the state, most of them are actually wrapping up their production for the season this year. So we've had a remarkably early start and oftentimes for a lot of folks, early finish to the season this year. So it's been very, very abnormal.
Can you talk us through why our weird winter weather has led to this early run of sap?
Yeah, in talking with the state climatologist Steve Avarice in preparation for the show today, he described this winter as more of a non-winter. We saw some really warm temperatures in January, and coupled with the lack of snowfall, we didn't really see the ground freezing in many parts of the state this year. So all those three factors put together just led to a situation where the sap was flowing really early this year. Many places of the state, it was in January. Oftentimes, as I mentioned, March is the typical tapping season in Wisconsin, but syrup producers in the state know that you have to be ready for whenever the weather is right. So last year was a little bit earlier than typical. Most folks were doing most of their sap harvesting in February. And then this year, again, we just were pushed a couple weeks earlier. And that was kind of that trifecta of the warm temperatures, the lack of snowfall, and also the lack of freeze that just allowed those trees to get those conditions early that caused the sap flow.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong. I was reading, I've never tapped maple syrup, but sap for maple syrup. As I understand it, the ideal when it's running is you want to freeze at night and then warmer during the day. So it's kind of that freeze and thaw is helping pump it out. Is that the ideal condition?
Yeah, exactly. So to simplify things, you're basically using that freeze-thaw cycle to create pressure inside of the tree that will, you know, on a perfectly sealed maple tree, will allow the sap to run up to the buds in the outermost branches in order to start the growing process for the season. But then when we tap a maple tree and put our the spile in, we're creating that wound that allows the pressure to push the sap right out of that spile, and then we're collecting the sap from the tree. And again, it's just based on the temperature differences that you get with that freezing and thawing. So yeah, typically in spring, you've got that time of the year again is often in March, when your nighttime temperatures will get down below freezing, and then when the sun is out during the day, you'll get those warm temperatures. And then when it's warm during the day, you'll see those really active sap flows, and then oftentimes at night, when it freezes again, it'll shut down. So you'll kind of have those periodic flows just during the warmest parts of the day.
Now we're seeing an earlier sap season for maples. I'm sure the numbers will be rolling in for a while now, but are you getting any sense from people, Tony, about the quantities they're getting? Is it more than usual, less than usual, normal?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I'm hoping we can get some folks from across the state to call in today. And, particularly folks who have records from the last couple of years that can compare the production this year with what's happened in the past. The producers that I've talked to, most of them have not reached their kind of production goals for the season at this point. And because of how warm we've gotten this week, a lot of parts of the state are seeing trees start to bud out. And once those buds start emerging, the sugars within the trees change, and the sap will no longer be good for making maple syrup. So the numbers are pretty tough to gauge. I know some producers who have said, particularly in the last week, they've seen record sap flows and, you know, might be able to make up for a slower start to the season. Traditionally what happens is the USDA has a survey of producers in the state every year. So we don't get the actual firm numbers until midsummer, usually around June, they release their production statistics. And it's hard to say. For my initial guesses, I'd say we're probably a little bit behind yet, but there might be some potential in parts of the state that are still a little bit cooler to make up for that, lack of production in the next coming weeks.
Tony Johnson is with us with the UW Extension Maple Syrup Program. And as you heard, you can help Tony out if you tap maple syrup or someone in your family does. How is it going this year? Did you get that early start? Are you getting a typical amount? Join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Tony, can you talk about the variety of producers of maple syrup, from the bigger commercial to the backyard folks? What is our mix in Wisconsin?
Yeah, that's one of the fun parts of my position as a maple syrup project manager with UW Extensions. I get to work with producers of all different sizes. So here in Wisconsin, we've got folks that are, tapping 1 to 2 trees in their yard and cooking it in small stock pots over propane fuel, and doing, a very small scale production for family, or maybe handing out gifts, all the way up to large scale commercial producers who are, working as maple syrup producers as their full-time job. So there is quite a bit of variety there. I think, one of the interesting things about Wisconsin is we are currently fourth in the nation in terms of maple syrup production. But the United States in general is far behind Canada. But here in Wisconsin, although we are fourth, there is a ton of potential for growth. So Wisconsin, although we trail Vermont, New York, and Massachusetts in terms of production, we've got more untapped maple trees on our landscape than any other state. So there is a lot of room for growth, and that's a big part of my project here with UW Extension. We've got a USDA grant-funded project to try to really understand what the needs are of producers at different scales. Everything from energy efficiency projects for large-scale producers who are, you know, making large investments in their business enterprises to thinking about some of the needs of, you know, small-scale producers who are just looking for opportunities to get their family out into the woods and think through some of those small barriers to production that we can assist with.
Let's start at that small end of the scale. Now, say somebody's eyeing some untapped potential in those few maple trees in their backyard. Like, what is the minimum they would need to do to get set up to start tapping and then, importantly, processing the sap into syrup?
Yep, that's right. So the first step is always going to be a positive identification of your maple trees. There's a couple of different species of maple trees that you can tap, and there's also trees that are not maples that are tappable to make syrup. So folks in Alaska, where there's not sugar maples, they'll tap birch trees to make birch syrup. You can tap walnut trees to make walnut syrup. But here in Wisconsin, since we have such a great supply of maple trees, and the sugar maple has the highest sugar content of any of the maple species, that's going to probably be the preferred tree for folks. But I'd also encourage people, if they don't have a sugar maple or don't have access to sugar maples, think about red maples and silver maples as other opportunities, as well as box elders. So step one is just positively identifying those trees and knowing what species you're working with. If you've got a sugar maple, a red maple, or a silver maple, the equipment you're going to need is pretty inexpensive, and there's a lot of different opportunities to kind of mix and match what you're using to make it a relatively inexpensive hobby. So what you're going to basically need a drill bit to tap the tree. So you're just drilling a small hole into the tree. You'll need a spile or a tap, which you will pound into the hole that you drilled in, and then you'll need some kind of a container to collect the sap that drips out of that spile. So folks will use bags. There's specific maple sap bags that you can purchase at Fleet Farm or any hardware store pretty inexpensively, or else you can just put a drill hole in a bucket and use a, you know, a 1 gallon bucket hanging from the tree, or maybe use a small piece of the maple tubing to connect the spile to a 5 gallon bucket on the ground. And then once you're actually collecting the sap from the tree, the next step is going to be getting all that sap together in a bulk container, and that could be something as simple as 5 gallon buckets or a cooler, and you're basically just holding your sap until you're ready to cook it. And then once you have your sap all ready to cook, you got to remember that that's a perishable food product, so it's got to be kept at a cool temperature, which oftentimes works out pretty well in the spring when it's cool. You can find a kind of a chillier part of the backside of a hill, maybe shovel some snow around your containers and keep those insulated until you're ready to cook. And then there's a lot of different opportunities or ways that you can actually evaporate off the water within the sap to cook down to your syrup. And that could be something as simple as, I said, a stock pot before with a propane burner. What I use on my small scale operation is some buffet pans, the stainless steel hotel buffet pans. You can get 8-quart or larger pans, and basically I'm just putting those over a fire and continuing to burn and boil my sap until it reaches that consistency of the syrup. And then once you get the sugar content exactly to the point where you're ready to bottle your syrup, you're going to be taking that finished product, filtering it, and then bottling it at a high temperature to create a shelf stable finished product. So by the end of this process, you can basically have a maple syrup on your shelf that could last for years and years. And at each point along the way, there are opportunities to invest a lot of money and increase your production and invest a lot in your equipment, or else you can kind of just recycle and use other supplies you have and do it pretty cheaply as well.
We're talking to forestry outreach specialist Tony Johnson about UW Extension's maple syrup program and how warmer winter weather affected syrup production here in the state. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Hey, I know you're out there. You've called in the past. I know some of you tap trees and make syrup yourself. Call in now at 800-642-1234. Let us know how it went for you this year. Perfectly normal, earlier than usual, bigger or lesser runs of sap. Join in at 800-642-1234. Tell us about your SAP experience this year. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Tony Johnson, Forestry Outreach Specialist and Project Manager for the UW Extension Maple Syrup Program. He's with us today to talk about this year's maple syrup season in Wisconsin as the warmer winter weather led to an early start to tree tapping. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of Wisconsin maple syrup? Do you have questions about how it is made? If you tap trees, make your own syrup. Love to hear what you're seeing this year. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Joe is with us in Green Lake. Joe, hi.
Yeah, hey, Rob. Hey, Tony. Good to talk to you.
What did you want to ask about, Joe?
Well, my question's a little bit off center here, but I'm planning on planting some new maple trees on my property. I'm just wondering how long a maple tree might take before it would be a good producer.
Oh, that's a perfectly on-target question, Joe. Tony, that's thinking for the future there. How long does it take for a baby maple to start producing enough sap to be worth tapping?
Yeah, that's a good question, and it's going to depend a lot on the site condition. So if you're planting a maple tree into optimal growing condition, it's got plenty of water and light and protection from competition, and that's going to include, you know, any of the perennial weeds like grasses that could really inhibit the growth early on, or else competition from other forest trees as it emerges will be kind of your big variables, and thinking through how fast that tree is going to potentially grow. We generally advise folks not to tap maple trees before they're in that 10-inch diameter at breast height. So if you walk up to the tree and about chest height, we want to see a tree that's about 10 inches across before you're tapping, and that will allow you to sustainably tap that tree, you know, kind of into perpetuity from that point on. Because as you get to a tree that's at least 10 inches across at chest height, once you tap it and the next year when you come back to tap that tree again, you'll rotate over 4 inches. And you, at that point, by the time you rotate each year and get all the way back to your original tap hole, you'll have seen enough growth on there to tap that same spot again. So with all those caveats, I would say, you know, you're going to have well over a decade before those trees are potentially tappable, I would say.
Joe, give us a call in 10 years. We'll try your product. Thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. Tony, how much sap does it take to make one unit of maple syrup after processing?
So the general rule is about 40 gallons of sap to make 1 gallon of syrup. So that is why we advise folks when you're cooking your sap down to do that outside. If you're evaporating that much water off in your kitchen, your wallpaper is going to probably peel off. So I will oftentimes bring my sap in when it is almost finished to finish it on the stovetop, and it adds a little bit of sweetness in the air and a little bit of humidity in the, you know, the kitchen in the winter. But yeah, it's going to be almost a 40-to-1 ratio from a generic tree. But it is important to know that sugar maples, the trees will vary quite a bit individually in their the sugar content of their sap, and that can vary year to year, and it can vary individual to individual. So we will often see that large trees that are in yards or on boulevards that don't have any competition, and they're, you know, they've got 365 degree canopy exposure to the sunlight, those trees will often have the highest sugar content of any maple trees that we test. And then they're oftentimes in a woodland where your maples are competing with other forest trees, and the canopies are much smaller, the sugar content will be less. So you could see, you know, potentially 4% sugar on a yard tree, and, you know, anywhere down to 1% sugar in a tree if it's, you know, a poor year.
Let's go back to our callers. Anna is with us in Lac-des-Flambeaux. Anna, hi.
Hi. We just actually just finished up our second boil in Lac-des-Flambeaux, where our trees aren't budded out yet, thankfully, and we're seeing great production right now. Been tapping out just as a family for many, many, many years, and my parents are in their 80s, and my mom is 83, still out there hauling buckets of sap for our boils. But one question I had was, We tap often the same trees year by year, and some years those trees produce like crazy, and sometimes they only produce a little. And I was wondering what's the reason behind that when it's the same tree from year to year.
Interesting, Anna. Thanks for the call. Tony, why is one tree prolific one year, not so much next year?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I would ask Anna if she's noticing those changes in all the trees in the sugar bush. If, you know, there may be a year when all the trees are relatively less productive. But honestly, that's I don't have a why an individual tree would vary so much. You got to kind of look at those microclimatic conditions and, you know, exactly where that tree is. And there might be some moisture issues or some tree disease issues off, you know, the Wisconsin woodlands have seen a lot of insect pests in the last couple of years, a couple that have done some defoliating on maple species, and that could be part of the factor too, but I don't have a great answer.
Anna, thanks for calling in and for sharing that family tradition with us. And mentioning lactoflambeau reminds me, Tony, I believe the maple syrup program at UW Extension works with tribal producers as well as the bigger businesses and the smaller hobbyists.
Yep, that's right. And I did want to comment on that. I think one on Anne's comment about the intergenerational opportunities that maple syrup brings. And I think that's one of the really fun aspects of this activity. You know, it really has a way of bringing kids and grandparents and, you know, everybody together, particularly around this, you know, one activity and one time of year. But on the extension program side of things, we do. We do have a lot of tribal partnerships right now. We actually had another grant-funded project called the Rural Partnerships Institute at UW Extension, where we are doing some indigenous food research and partnering with tribes. And we actually recently hired on an indigenous tribal sovereignty food specialist who's going to be spearheading some of the maple activities this year. But last winter, we hosted several maple syrup learning exchanges with different tribal partners in Wisconsin and Minnesota. And yeah, I think that's definitely one of the many stakeholders that we are really interested in engaging. And, you know, part of our initial program with an extension was to kind of jump back into the maple world and try to understand what the needs are of different producers in the state. And we definitely found that the tribal folks that we were working with had a little different lens on some of the activities and a little different historical connection that we wanted to tap into, no pun intended. So that is definitely a big part of our programming.
And just briefly, Tony, what's your favorite thing to do with the maple syrup once it's made?
Well, I've got three kids under six at home, and we are all about the pancakes and waffles in the morning. So that's my goal. I got to produce enough syrup to keep the kids happy and have enough for gifts for all the friends and family. So as long as they're happy, I'm happy.
Tony, thanks so much for joining us.
Yep, thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity.
That's Tony Johnson, Forestry Outreach Specialist and Natural Resources Educator at UW Extension and Project Manager for Extension's Maple Syrup Program, with us to talk about the maple syrup season in Wisconsin after it got off to an early start thanks to warm winter weather. Tomorrow, we'll check out this year's Wisconsin Film Festival, featuring a lot of movies made here in the state or by Wisconsin filmmakers. Get a sneak preview, that and more, tomorrow on Central Time.